It's Tuesday, September 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a coup in Africa's Burkina Faso may be ending.
The estimate is 2% of them could be ISIS fighters, or maybe even as high as 5. So I think both sides have a point.
Concerns about hidden Islamic State fighters among Syrian refugees. Also ahead, China's president comes to Washington amid a variety of issues. TV viewers are on their last season of a popular series. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. The leader of last week's coup in Burkina Faso has apologized to the country and says he's planning to hand over power to a civilian government. In a statement Monday, General Gilbert Dindere said that he will step down as the country's de facto leader at the conclusion of talks mediated by the Economic Community of West African States. The regional group is holding an emergency summit in Nigeria's capital later Tuesday to discuss the situation. Emily Yab has been following the latest for VOA, and she joins me by telephone from Ouagadougou. Emily, what have you seen there today?
Today we have heard that troops from the Burkina army was routing to the capital city, to Ouagadougou, and have asked to the people behind the coup to lay down a weapon and to basically surrender. And like in Ouagadougou right now, when the news spread in town, people would just like leave home, and it's basically a ghost town. There is a curfew on right now, and the town is basically empty except outside the building where the general is. There is a rumor that the general is there, the Putschist leader. So there is like some people gathered there, but it's just a rumor, and nobody knows for sure where he is.
There was a statement at the conclusion of talks mediated by the Economic Community of West African States that the general who staged the coup will be, in fact, stepping down.
Well, that was one of the recommendations from the proposed peace deal that was announced yesterday evening. And today, the general indeed said that he was going to agree to this peace deal, and he was going to give back the power to the transition government, which he always said he would do. So it's just confirming what he always said he would do. But what he gets from the peace deal is an amnesty for the putsch, and he also gets included elections, which were the main domain of the putschists.
Well, that was going to be my next question, is what happens to the general and the presidential guard which staged this coup?
Well, we don't know yet, because the proposed peace deal that was raised yesterday is very much criticized by anti-coup protesters. They have the feeling that the putschists, that the peace deal is very much in favor of the putschists, that they get everything they wanted, and they have an amnesty, which means they're not being held responsible for all the injured people and the dead people that have happened in the past few days. And for many of them, it's unbearable. It has to be discussed tomorrow in Nigeria, this peace deal, but we don't know if it's going to be implemented. We don't know what the army intervention is going to change. It's a lot of doubt here.
Is there a sense that the interim prime minister, who is to be released, will return to power?
That is correct. One of the compromises that the general agreed on was to release Isaac Zida, the prime minister, who is also the former leader of the soldiers behind the coup. So, yes, that's one of the conditions of the peace deal, and that the general agreed on.
The streets are empty now. What was the scene there earlier? Were people going about their business as normal? Was there a sense of tension?
Well, this morning there were still, like the past few days, there were still roadblocks put up by anti-coup protesters to protest against the peace deal and the amnesty toward the putschists. So this was still going on this morning. And when the news spread of the army troops coming to town, then people started to just go home, and so the streets were getting emptier.
Well, Emily Yab, we appreciate you coming on the phone with us, and we wish you safe travels.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're going to check out what people are saying on the internet. As always, our social media guru, G. Abby Lee, is joining me in Studio 22, and she has the latest. Hello, G. What's happening in Burkina Faso, and what sort of attention is it getting online?
Hi, Jim. So it's getting a lot of attention, which is kind of surprising and awesome because what happens in Africa doesn't always get the amount of attention they deserve. But international media outlets are actively reporting on today's development for multiple reasons. Now let's begin with Washington Post. It is a fascinating article that details whether Burkina Faso can become a stable democracy. And the analysis covers the last week's coup, what's next for the country, and everything in between. The post is on Twitter at Washington Post.
Well, what about media outlets outside of the United States?
Well, Al Jazeera English, which is based in Qatar, shared an interesting article and a photo from last year. It's on Twitter at AJ English, and the tweet reads like this. From the archives, Burkina Faso, ghost of Africa's Che Guevara. That's been retweeted more than 100 times. It's referring to one of Africa's youngest leaders, Thomas Sankara, who was murdered at the age of 37 back in the 80s. The article really captures how Burkina Faso suffers from a long history of political upheavals.
Mm, and that unfortunate history is repeating itself in that country. Gee, before you go, are there any reactions from Washington on Twitter?
Well, nothing significant today, but there was a tweet about Burkina Faso a few days ago. Linda Thomas-Greenfield is the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, and she tweeted this last Friday. The U.S. is deeply concerned about events in Burkina Faso. We call for the immediate release of all government officials. In that tweet, she also shared a link to a press statement by the State Department spokesman John Kirby. Her handle is at State Africa. Jim?
Well, great analysis as always from G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. Also, don't forget to follow our main account with G and the rest of our social media team, tweeting at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States will resettle at least 85,000 refugees in fiscal 2016. And that begins right around the corner on October 1st and includes a minimum of 10,000 Syrians and 100,000 refugees by 2017. But some Republican lawmakers have warned that terrorist groups like the Islamic State have made it abundantly clear they will use the refugee crisis to try to enter the United States. Regional analyst and associate professor Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver told VOA's Victor Beatty that the vetting process should be manageable.
The estimate is 2% of them could be ISIS fighters or maybe even as high as 5. So I think both sides have a point. I think clearly this is not a very large number compared to the 4 million Syrians who've already fled the country and another 7 million who've gone to other places within Syria. But on the other hand, it would seem to me that our intelligence ought to be fairly good enough so that we would be able to, you know, at least spot a significant number of them. So I think when you balance it out, it's a concern. I think it is up to the intelligence agencies. But on the whole, there are profiles that, you know, should, you know, select out those people that we might be concerned about.
Russia's military backing, according to Mr. Kerry at his comments on Sunday, for the Syrian regime risks sending even more extremists to the war-torn country and could further hamper any effort to bring peace. Does he have a point?
Oh, there's no question about it. But the problem is, whose responsibility is this? In other words, we had an opportunity 3 years ago to really back up and arm and train the pro-Western secular moderates. And we skipped over that. And the result is that things have degenerated. I mean, if you just look at the numbers I was just quoting, over 50% of Syrians have either been killed, 250,000, left the country, 4 more million, or 7 million, who are already upended from where they spent their entire lives. So the situation is getting worse. And you perhaps saw that even the French now are talking about coming back into the bombing campaign. So I would hope that the administration will rethink this. We need to stop ISIS, and at the same time, we need to be more committed, not just verbally, but also in reality, to overthrow a regime that has done such horrendous things that violate even the most basic human rights all over the world.
Some 80 more U.S.-trained Syrian rebels have reentered the country. Is that going to help change the calculus at all?
Well, not when you're talking about tens of thousands of people on the other side. I think that, and the earlier statistics were like 5 to 20. I think, frankly, the situation has just swept beyond what we can do in a kind of objective, moderate way. We've got to decide what kind of Syria we want. Does it matter to us? Or do we basically turn it back over to the Iranians, the Russians, and Bashar Assad? So I think there's a fundamental issue here that we really haven't confronted for a variety of reasons.
Syria's Foreign Minister Walid Mualim said on Sunday that Russia's growing military role in his country will prove to be a game changer in the fight against jihadists.
I think that's a byproduct to a certain degree, but I think fundamentally the Russians want to hold on to their longest and most traditional base, which is in Syria, and they've already got TARDIS as their naval base, and now they're going to have an Air Force base. So I think the Russians would be thinking about that, but their main interest, of course, like every other country, is what's good for them. And this reinforces their image, especially in Sunni Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, like the United Arab Emirates, like Jordan and Egypt, that Russia is a militarily reliable country on which they can rely because they're coming to the rescue one more time to Bashar Assad, who, as horrible as he is, they see as preferable to the other side.
In his remarks, Secretary of State Kerry said that he and his German counterpart were also determined to attack the root causes of the Syrian refugee crisis, insisting that there is no military solution to the conflict. Chinese President Xi Jinping is visiting the United States, and he comes to Washington for his first state visit. VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide tells Ira Melman about delicate issues and areas the two nations share.
They sure have a full plate, from the South China Sea issues to cybersecurity, China's relationship with Japan, which is an ally of the United States. There are many areas where these two countries are trying to deal with their relationship and the challenges that rise up. And that's not to mention the other persistent issues that have long been there regarding human rights, whether it be in Tibet or Xinjiang, or just the average everyday citizen in China and the lack of freedoms that they do not enjoy.
Well, you know, if you were to list the thorniest problems, what would be at the top of your list?
Well, at this point, going into the meetings, it seems that cybersecurity is the top issue. And that is because of the impact that it's had on U.S. businesses. We're not talking necessarily about cyber espionage and stealing of maybe information about President Obama's meetings and what he's saying behind closed doors. The president made it clear that what he's really concerned about the most, President Obama, that is the theft of intellectual property and also it could be military hardware, secrets, technology as well.
Where do you see issues of common ground as she prepares to leave?
Well, we definitely know that in terms of climate change, this has been one of the areas where the two are trying to work together, trying to help set a standard for the rest of the world, and hopefully that one will follow. We'll have to see, you know, what kind of further agreements are made during the visit. The other thing is that Xi is bringing with him a big entourage of businessmen, so there may be some progress in that area as well. The two countries are also working on a bilateral investment treaty, and it is hoped that some conclusion or some progress will be made during the visit regarding that. So those are a few areas where we might see some progress come and should be some high points.
VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Eide. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The final season is now underway for a television series that has gained an unexpected and large following worldwide. David Byrd takes us into the world of Downton Abbey.
Downton Abbey is truly a worldwide phenomenon. The drama about the fictional Crawley family is shown in more than 100 countries. ITV, which commissioned the show, says an average of 11 million viewers watch the series in Britain alone. In the United States, last season's finale was seen by more than 25 million people. But now, the final season has come, and cast members have mixed emotions about it. Actor Hugh Bonneville, who plays family patriarch Robert Crawley, the 7th Earl of Grantham, says the time feels right for the show to close.
Originally it was going to be 5, and then I went and had a chat with Julian, and I wanted to see the whites of his eyes about whether he wanted to do a 6th, and he said, and he explained why he wanted to do a 6th.
The show began with the sinking of the Titanic in 1912 and has followed the Crawley family through 13 years of love and tragedy. The 6th season will carry the storyline to the edge of the Great Depression. Elizabeth McGovern plays Cora, Countess of Grantham. She says that the storyline follows the history of large houses in England at the time.
They're not able to continue the life as they know it much beyond that, the decade of the 20s. So that sort of works well for the story. The lifestyle is ending as our series is ending.
The show is filmed at Highclere Castle in Newbury, West Berkshire, currently the home of the Earl and Countess of Carnarvon. The castle has provided fans with stunning views of its interiors, including the main staircase, the dining room, the drawing room, and the library. Downton Abbey has also been a boon for the castle, with tours selling out months in advance. The success of the series, including 59 Emmy nominations and 11 wins, surprised writer Julian Fellowes, who thought that it was aimed mainly at a British audience.
And then it opened in America and became a very big hit there, and then China and Asia and, you know, Africa, and all of these whole continents took to the show. And I can't really explain why particularly, but I'm terribly pleased they did.
While many of the family scenes are filmed in the castle, the downstairs scenes involving the servants are done in a studio because the real kitchens and servant areas are not suitable. Jim Carter, who plays the strict butler Mr. Carson, says the final servants scene turned out to be the final scene of the final episode, which made for an emotional wrap-up.
So we were in the servants' hall, all the gang, candle-lit. Quite a sort of a muted sort of scene, not a big dramatic scene, quite low-key. And then they said, cut, and that's goodbye to all the servants. And then I sort of thought, oh, we should thank all the wonderful crew there. And I started to say a few words on behalf of everybody. Before I knew it, oh my God, I was a mess. And then I looked around and all the crews were like this, all the blokes all crying. And yeah, it was a soggy mess.
Very sad.
Michelle Dockery, Lady Mary Crawley to fans of the show, says though it's sad to leave her cast members, in the end, Downton Abbey is just a television show.
It's still a drama and there has to be some sense of, you know, it's make-believe, it's not real. So I think it's important not to take it too seriously.
Show producer Gareth Neem says that there's nothing to stop someone from making a newer version of the Crawley saga. But for now, he says that cameras are moving away from the Crawleys. Downton Abbey began its final season in Britain September 20th. American fans will have to wait to see it on PBS's Masterpiece beginning in January. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Downton Abbey is coming to a close later on. We hope that our series continues. We'll find out. You've been listening to International Edition, and you can find us at voanews.com. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Zeynep Abdel-Rahman, and I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us, and we hope you have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Economic disparity, often in combination with other factors, can open the door to violent extremism. Across many parts of the Middle East and North Africa, economic policies have led to the creation of parallel but deeply polarized economies, said U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli. One is formal and often extends the full range of society's benefits to a relatively small and privileged group, but exacerbates perceptions of unfairness. The other economy is informal, marked by insecurity and characterized by low pay and little hope for a better future. According to the World Bank, the typical country in the Middle East and North Africa produces about 27% of its GDP in the informal economy and employs 67% of its labor force informally. In many countries, it is almost impossible for an individual to move from the informal sector to the formal sector, said Undersecretary Novelli. Women, she said, participate in the Middle East's workforce at the world's lowest rate. Many women, when they can't find jobs in the formal sector, become discouraged over time and end up dropping out of the labor force. ISIL has exploited these frustrations in its recruitment efforts by promising women valued positions in their state, and hundreds of women have fallen prey to this narrative. It is important to note that ISIL wants to cast blame on capitalism, or modernity, for creating many of these inequities. In the Middle East and North Africa, ISIL presents a false choice between the unjust status quo and a romanticized version of a 7th-century economy. The most effective way to confront these challenges is for countries to pursue sound market economy principles, embrace transparency and the rule of law, and ensure that all people have the opportunity to succeed. Embracing such reforms can go a long way toward blunting the message of violent extremists.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.